There was an interesting, I'm not quite sure what the word is, I was going to say tension, between your public statements, by which I would include statements in seminars or even at the dinner table, and sometimes how you would come across one-on-one in a kind of Kalyana Mitra relationship. You know, for example, you were quite openly and consistently critical of the extent to which people would lose themselves in neurotic sexual relationships. And there was quite a long era in our history where anyone involved in a heterosexual sexual relationship would feel in an uncomfortable position in relation to the group. The group's attitude seemingly, at least, to have come from things you said. And yet, if one went to see you personally, as I can remember doing myself, to discuss one's sexual relationships, you were so kind, so understanding, so tolerant.
Yeah. Well, of course, when I see anybody, one-to-one, whether it was at that time or now, I give them my whole attention, and I'm just concerned with them and their particular problem, if it is a problem, and just that. I'm not concerned with, so to speak, applying any sort of general rule to their situation. I don't think I ever do that. I see what they are like, what they're going through, what their situation is, and respond to that. But when I speak, as it were, more publicly, I deal in generalities. And then, of course, I follow the Buddhist tradition. And, of course, the Buddhist tradition is that if you are free from domestic encumbrances, you are more likely, at least, to be able to give all your energy and attention to the Dharma. So that was my general stance.
But also, as, for example, represented in your short story, The Artist's Dream. You had a pretty intense relationship of your own with that degree of totality.
Well, I remember The Artist's Dream very well, and that grew directly out of my experience on retreats. And it mirrored that experience.
To the extent that you saw people being distracted.
Definitely. So blatant. And my experience on those retreats gave birth to The Artist's Dream.
But just for a moment to take the Artist's Dream as a paradigm of, if you like, a public statement, or what seems to be a public statement. My sense is that you have always been, when it's come down to the individual, completely open, completely empathic, compassionate, and so on. And yet, clearly in statements, the sort of statement implied by The Artist's Dream and so on, there are these much more challenging, demanding points being made, which the FWBO's culture would take hold of and give a life perhaps quite separate or different from the life that you intended in the first place. And again, I'm just interested to know whether that was something you were aware of, that was happening, that there was a dynamic in our culture that could translate you into something perhaps a little harder edged than you intended.
Well, I'm sure that happens sometimes, because I'm being translated all the time. Sometimes people translate later into softer terms, sometimes into harsher terms. This happens all the time. I think everybody practically in the FWBO, especially in the order, does translate me to some extent. And it's faster on one aspect of me rather than on another.
And as maybe those waves of cultural excitement over certain issues and views, as they ran through the movement, possibly there were times when you thought, well, for the sake of the experiment we're conducting, let's see what happens. I mean, I suppose, let's take the example of what happened in Croydon during the 80s, where you must have known that some of your ideas and teachings were being applied in a pretty rigid and even harsh way. I mean, I know you were aware of that. But I also wonder whether, there was also on your part an openness to the fact that, well, we don't really yet know how to do it, and at least there's energy here. Let's give it a go and see what happens for a while.
No, I wasn't at all happy with the way that things were going on in Croydon at that time. I didn't think of that as an experiment or as an interesting way of applying what they thought were my teachings. I didn't see it in that way at all. I thought what was going on there, as I'd come to know about it, I definitely thought was wrong. But it was very difficult to get the people there to admit that. And also, of course, Croydon was set up as an independent centre, like all our centres, so they weren't obliged to listen to my advice. They couldn't be forced to listen to anybody's advice. One can't set up a relatively democratic organisation and then complain that somebody doesn't intervene in a dictatorial way. So we had to find some way of handling the situation, which we eventually did. But I certainly didn't think of Croydon and its degree of extremism as an interesting experiment or something that could be allowed to take its course. I saw it as a development tendency that had to be stopped. I saw that quite clearly, and in the end it was stopped.
But to also have to, in a way, watch and wait and bide your time and work kind of cautiously and slowly because of those factors.
Well, I'm used to waiting and watching and biding my time, and I still do it.
But that presumably was painful. I mean, I can remember the occasion, an occasion, and in a way quite a crucial occasion at Padmaloka, where you finally revealed the extent of the pain you were in.
Well, it certainly was painful because it was a distortion of something that I had taught or something that I wanted to do. Well, there were these lines in Kipling. If you can bear to see the truth you've uttered, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, that is a very painful thing. Kipling puts it more strongly than I would care to, but that's the nature of that situation. It was very painful. And of course it is also painful to me, even now, to see not when people are implementing my teachings more rigidly, but when they are implementing them in a much more slack manner. In some ways, that is even more dangerous and even more painful. And that has been going on.